I'm Josh Cooperman, and this is Convo by Design. If you're new to the podcast, welcome. If you've been listening for a while, thank you. One of the most rewarding things about doing this podcast is that I meet new architects, designers, artists, product manufacturers, show producers, and fans of design all the time. Here are a few things we all have in common. We love beautiful design and amazing architecture. We all love talking about beautiful design and amazing architecture. And best of all, we all have very different opinions as to what does and does not qualify as beautiful and or amazing. I get approached quite often at industry events from people who heard an episode, interview, or panel discussion and either agree completely or disagree entirely. There is a passion, and it makes for some remarkable conversations. I had the chance to sit down with Gary Gibson, designer, artist, sculptor, showroom owner, and collector. I met Gary on a trip, one of these events, to Modernism Week, and we instantly hit it off. Gary's a debater. If he wants to speak with you, he doesn't care if you agree with him or disagree with him. He's honest, and better, he's informed. Gary's one of those people that make you smarter at the end of a conversation. You know what I mean? He's also someone that doesn't have to be right, which is a rarity these days. Gary and I discuss a lot here. From Modernism Week to showroom curation and management, Gary talks about collecting, picking, and love of surface texture, and way more than that. Thank you for listening. If you like what you hear, and I hope that you do, please go to Apple Podcasts and leave us a note and a 5-star rating. It helps new listeners find the podcast. Enjoy this conversation with Gary Gibson. Convo by Design is presented by Snyder Diamond. Always first with what's next in the kitchen and bath. What does that mean? Well, it means that Russ Diamond scours the planet looking for the best products that make life better. As of this recording, he's in Italy at Salone. It's amazing. He doesn't just pick pretty products. He goes to the company to see how the products are made, to make sure you are getting the highest quality, and then he and his staff provide just simply remarkable service to make shopping a pleasure. And when one of these companies introduce a new product or a new product line that is going to change the way we live, it's a pretty big deal. Miele is one of those companies, and Miele is proud to introduce the new W1 washing machine and T1 dryer. I am super excited about this, and I think you will be as well. Why? Because this washer-dryer combo includes Miele's immer besser spirit, Miele's stunning good looks, and technology that will not only make washing and drying clothes a better experience, it'll save water, energy, and more. The quick intense wash, for example. High level of clean in under an hour. Homeowners are going to flip for the steam finish of the T1 dryer. My favorite new feature is the Wi-Fi Connect. Download the Miele mobile app and you can operate and receive notifications on your mobile device. Architects and designers, this is yet another product from Miele that you won't even think about trying to hide. All this, Snyder Diamond service, and for a limited time, you can find very generous offers from Miele on these and other Miele products at all three Los Angeles area Snyder Diamond showrooms. You can find addresses and store hours at snyderdiamond.com. I've known Gary, I don't know how long we've been speaking now, since Modernism Week. So since February.
Yes.
Of 2018.
Correct.
What did you think of Modernism Week?
Well, you know, growing up here, I went as a kid down there. Now it's a whole different objective to go down there. I find that it's fascinating for different reasons than the obvious, I think, because this goes to kind of back to me and how I see things. Why do we go down there? The vendors at this shows tend to have product that we've seen already, so I'm a little disappointed in that, but I also think we're jaded in LA because we're so overexposed to mid-century, and that's kind of what it's about. I think to see some of the homes and have access to properties that we normally don't get to is probably the perk of going down there. But I find shows are very difficult to excite people anymore. I think we're so overexposed with social media, visuals of other sorts, that you can travel the world online.
See, and it's great because you just reminded me. I love it. Every time we get together and every time we chat, I am reminded why I enjoy talking to you so much. And one of the reasons why I really wanted to talk to you here for Convo by Design. You do things differently. You have a vastly different approach to the business. And it is a business for you. It's you've wanted to, we'll get more into how you got started, but you're a designer, you're an artist, you're a sculptor, you're a showroom owner. So you have all these different hats that you wear as part of the business, but you also, there's really no BS when you explain it too. You know, see, it's funny because for me, Modernism Week, I love mid-century modern. Uh-huh. So I can go and I can look at this at these houses all day.
Correct.
That's just a personal thing. But what you're saying, you know, from a, the shows need to do more to yes. entertain you and engage. Right. It's a great point. Why don't they?
I don't know if it's lack of creativity or laziness or, I don't think it's not the willing to try, but I think it goes back to what you're saying. How I do it is you really have to think out of the box and be different. Don't follow mainstream. Don't be a trend. As we were discussing before about a conversation I had, and it's about trends are what I think magazines do to sell product, and I get that, but at least that's their game. I like to buck the system, so to speak, and my path and my willingness to challenge myself and to be different from everybody, I always say is my success. And I think when people take the risk, it'll pay off if you have the perseverance. And I think, it's so hard because I do these lectures at UCLA of these new students that want to be designers. And I think it's so different from when I did the old school way of not having the computer at your fingertips and Googling Prouvet chairs, Eames tables, and 5,000 pictures come up. We had to go out and hunt them down. If a client said, I need an English buffet, I had to go to an antique dealer or wherever. You don't have to do that anymore. And I think you lose something in the translation from technology, which is so great on many levels, but to live and breathe and expose yourself to touching and feeling, creating relationships with dealers and showrooms, and just interacting with people is key to who you are. So when it goes back to your question of why aren't these shows better, I think they just keep doing the same formula routine, and no one's come up with the next iteration of how we do this, because I think what's happened is people are a little lazy because they've retreated to the computer. And why go to Palm Springs? Why go to the convention? Why go to a show when I could just do it online? I've had students say to me, why would I go to showrooms when I could just Google it and buy it online? And I'm like, oh, you're missing out on the content and the why you want to be a designer. It's so many facets to what this is about. It's about, it's so complicated to me, but it's really simple. It's like you have to live and breathe this. And I started out wanting to be an artist. I was an artist. I became a designer. I became a product designer. I opened the store. But it's always been just very organic and cathartic. And just like, I never had an agenda like, next year I'm going to open a store. I just decided. And I don't know that you can do that now, because I think the times have changed, as we know how brick and mortar is suffering. You can't just go rent a space without spending $30,000 to be in the key areas you need to be, because it's so about location, location. So reverting back to your question again about Palm Springs, I think it goes back to costs. I think shows are expensive. The people that come and used to show at these shows it gets costly. If you're out of town, if you're from Europe, the expense of travel, the expense of your product, the show space, and what is your return? The return isn't great enough anymore. And unfortunately, we've gotten to the point where it's about numbers, totally. And not, it's this bottom line sensibility. It's that corporate kind of mentality. The thing for me is I base it on artistic endeavors rather than the bottom line. I have been fortunate with my design business and the store and the product to be successful at it. Therefore, I can take risk with the store or product because I can challenge myself and create things that people wouldn't do. Like I'm taking risks that, well, I'm just going to buy this product or I'm going to design this because it really always sells. I want to test myself creatively to be, make it interesting and fun to me. I think that's the thing for me is enjoying what I do. I'm not reinventing the wheel. I'm not curing cancer. I'm creating spaces for people. I've created a store that people like. I create product that people like. So it takes that challenge and the risk.
What are you first? Showroom owner, designer, artist, entrepreneur?
See, I guess I would call myself an entrepreneur. But I hate that word because I think I'm just an artist and I work in different mediums. And when I say mediums, I mean I paint, I design furniture, I create spaces, because I see it all as art. And I think it's about juxtaposition of space and scale and textures and materials. So I don't like to just say I'm a designer. I like to say, you can say I'm an entrepreneur, but I could just call myself an artist. Because next week I might do something totally different again.
And you know, the next question is going to seem daunting in its size and scale, but ultimately, I don't think there are that many reasons for it. But how has the business changed since you got started?
Well, like I said, one of the main things is you used to have to go out and hunt for textiles, vendors that did special materials, that made special things, that unique antiques or objects. You didn't have the internet to Google it and search it and MapQuest to tell you how to get there. It was like a scavenger hunt. You know, you would either do it in this country or go to Europe and ask friends where to find great Italian directoire furniture or whatever you're looking for. I think the business of design, what I hear for younger designers, it's hard for people to afford a designer because the designer is, I don't think, is charging enough, because I think the consumer, the end user, because they can go to a store, the salespeople aren't salespeople anymore, they're also designers. And I think everyone is offering services that's kind of cutting out that entry-level designer. So I think it's hurt the business that way. So I think it's hard to start out on a financial level. The things, like I said, at UCLA, these are second careers for people. They always want to be a designer, which is great, but when you're 45, and you're not going to be an intern for a designer and make, you know, whatever you're going to make and survive. So how do you make that work? And I think the business of design is really hard. And I think people think that it's not. It's a lot of smoke and mirrors in that it looks glamorous, but it's really work.
Do you think, too, what I'm getting, too, is that the internet is sort of this grand equalizer. You know, between up and coming designers students who don't feel like they need to work that hard to go out and actually source and shop. And like we're, you know, when you talk about a student who says, you know, go to a showroom, why would I want to do that? Well, because you want to feel it. You want to feel it between your tactile. You want to feel it. You want to look at it. You want to sit in it. You want to see the material under the lights. For end user, for the clients, I mean, listen, it used to be cost plus. And, you know, then it's fee-based, and maybe there's a hybrid or a combination between cost-plus and fee-based, and that's how you figure out your overall compensation. But now, if a homeowner in the middle range, low to mid-range, can go on Pinterest, see a room, and say, oh, I like that, I'm just going to go source the materials for our own place, and then hire a handyman to paint and put it all together. I mean...
But you kind of just... give a synopsis of how it works now. I get people every week that have just bought a house. They come in, I throw out some prices. Ooh, well, we don't even have any furniture yet. Well, you got to go buy your sofas and your bigger pieces first before you buy our objects and stuff like that. I don't think they comprehend. They love the uniqueness, and that's the beauty of what we do here. Is it's vintage. That's really unique. We've curated it in a way that people understand how you could use an object that's been found. But they don't get the cost. Well, the cost, I'm on Beverly. You've just had brunch at a nice restaurant. I spend my time curating and traveling all over to find this stuff. They want flea market pricing at a top-notch store. Well, you're not going to get that. And so they're a little surprised. I think... the flea market sensibility now is huge. I mean, you go to a flea market. I don't go that often anymore, but you see just groves of people with carts. I'm not sure what they're buying it for because there's a lot of stuff out there that's really, you know, like everyone can buy stuff, but it's how you put it together. And that's what a designer does, is put stuff together for you. If you brought me a truck full of stuff, I could cherry pick it and style it in your interior and be fine. But I'm not going to use all of it. So I'm curious why people buy so much stuff. And I've been to people's homes where they've considered hiring me. And they go, what do you think of this? And I go, what is it? What did you buy it for? Well, it was a great price. Well, we're so consumed by price. You know, there's so many outlets now. And this goes back to the internet. So many retail stores, and we know the names, that it's about the price. It's not a lamp is just a lamp now. A chair is just a chair. It doesn't matter what it's covered in. It doesn't matter who made it. The chair is $500. You want $3,500 for this? No. There's still a market there, but that pie is going back to the business of design, that luxury mark, that one percenter. They've drank the Kool-Aid of the retail stores too. They can go there and they go, well, why would I spend all this money for this sofa when I can go there for a sofa? The fabric's different. The construction's different. We've blurred the lines of construction, quality, colors, textures, content of materials. Those are important to me in the high-end market. A lot of people don't care because it's about the cost. And I think it's a sad commentary because we all like nice things, I believe. We may not all can afford it, but you compromise. If I'm given a budget, like I know how to take a budget and get inexpensive things, but then the key pieces we're going to spend some money on, because those are the pieces that are focal points and important to the room to make it work.
It's an interesting commentary on the state of the design industry as it is right now. As we've sort of gotten here, I think it's evident as to how we've gotten here. What do you think is the future of the trade? And it's funny because I love having this conversation, and I love having it with you because you are multidisciplinary. You have all these different angles that you come from. What is the future of the industry? I'm not a designer. I'm not in the business every day, but I've spoken to enough people who are, who live in it. I mean, you know, you look at we're coming off West Week, mm-hmm. and you were at the Pacific Design Center. The Design Center used to be the central capital in Southern California. if you wanted to see something, you had to go to the showroom and you had to see it. You don't have to anymore.
Right.
You don't have to.
Right.
It's still a monument to what it used to be. What's the future of the design industry?
Well, usually most things like this are cyclical, but I think this is going to take a while to come back, or if it ever will, to what it was. Like you say, West Week used to be a full week of market, of new product, and that was the showcase of new product. You got people from all over the world, all over the country. Now it's a day and a half. I think it goes back to a little bit of the modernism show concept. West Week does kind of the same thing. There's panel discussions, there's a few cocktail parties, and then everyone goes home. It's almost like the importance of what the market's about has been lost. and we all regurgitate, where is it going? What are the trends? I think that you need to hunker down and just do your work. I have this philosophy of, like, I put my blinders on. I'm in the mix, but I'm also in my little bubble. And I said this at West Week, that I tend to live in my bubble because it's safer for me. Social media is great for me to see what's going out in the world without having to be everywhere. It shortcuts your life. But it's not the sole way I get my source of information. I'm still out there. I think people think that they could use their social media as their only source of communicating with the world. I've been told that designers have developed careers off of social media, where, and I hear this a lot, and I go, really? And I guess because I'm old school, it seems so foreign to me, but I see how it does happen. And I think that will continue, but I think it's got to come back, and I've seen it a little bit start where people, like, I'm so tired, I need a break from social media. I need a break from the retail stores. And I see more and more people come into the brick and mortar, the more boutique, the more specialized stores, where they want unique product that's not mass consumed. You know, you know the stores we go to that everybody, you go to someone's house and they, oh, I know where you got those. You lose the integrity of what interior design's about. We're designing for individuals in their space and only for them, and creating environments that are unique to them. And that's not the only reason you're doing it, but people like, I guess, bragging rights, that this is a painting I did when I was a child, and we've incorporated it in with all this other stuff from our past, and we bought this new piece because we were traveling in Italy. And you make things work, and then it gives your home a soul, and it has some purpose, and it has some meaning. It's not generic, you know. It's like the days of model homes. You're going, oh, that's really pretty, but who lives here? Well, no one does, of course, but it's just, you get the concept of space and scale, and it's helpful. Because I remember when I was younger, I used to love to go to model homes because I loved to see how they tricked the eye with scale. I don't know. I think because the money and the business aspect of what our industry's about, it'll take a long time to come back. I don't think it'll ever come back to where it was. It's a huge statement, I think. But I don't think that we've been spoiled by a price point.
You know, it's interesting. As I'm listening to you talk, I'm sort of thinking about, a whole bunch of things. But, you know, living here in L.A., it's almost like the celebritization of the design industry is sort of what's taken the special shine off of it. You know, before the Kardashians, you had Jane Mansfield, and you had the Pink Palace. You know, you had this home for the time. It was, what, late 60s, yeah. early 70s. Yeah. Jane Mansfield and this house that I forgot the name of her husband, who's Mr. Universe 55. But the whole house, right. The whole house is pink, and it's got pink shag carpet, and it's got a heart shaped bed, and
Mickey Hargitay.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah,
and you know, it's just that was celebrity design that at the time, and that was it was aspirational.
But it was like in Life magazine.
Yes,
it wasn't in People. It wasn't in your face on social media. What we've been like the home industry and design industry have exploded with. We're all hawking something now, and I say that as a hypocrite because I do social media and I have a store and product and we want to put it out there, but I find that it's like shameless marketing anymore, where it's so blatant.
So you're probably the best person to ask this of. Taking the experience of knowing that that's what you use to promote, self-promote, and drive the brand. How do you make the industry? How do you get the shine back? How do you make design? And it's funny because I differentiate design from architecture.
Yes. Oh yeah.
I think right now we're having a remarkable renaissance in architecture. I really do, especially in Southern California.
Right.
Primarily because in Southern California, with the climate, you can do just about anything you want to do. And with the California mindset, where, you know, there really are no limitations except those that you impose on yourself, you can really do anything. And we're seeing some remarkable things out here yet in a number of different disciplines. From the design standpoint, how do you make it special again?
Well, you brought up the celebrity factor, which I think is interesting. I've never wanted to be famous. I want Gibson, the brand, to be out there. But if no one knew who I ever was, I'd be really happy. I have no need, or my ego doesn't have any need, to be known. And I think we're having that period right now where everybody, including celebrities, want to be out there for home and design. And I think it's close to being exhausted right now, because a lot of people, and I've had this conversation with several people and manufacturers, is do you think our product is being driven or the numbers are going up based on a celebrity? And I don't think so at all. And so every designer wants to create textiles. Every designer wants to create furniture, rugs, whatever. And I've done that, but it was many years ago. But it was more the basis of why I wanted to do it. It was a creative process for me, and to learn to do that, and to do it and execute it and see it come to fruition. And they sold, and then I was done. I think that so many people want to license themselves anymore, and I know some successful people that, of course, have done that. And they go that route, and they kind of become real product designers. But mainstream designers, I think they see the smoke and mirror aspect again. Why, oh my God, I want to design rugs, I want to design tile, I want to design textiles. Well, it's a little overrated. I mean, it goes back to what this is all about, is passion. And design is about being passionate, and it goes for me back to being an artist. At the end of the day, if people come in and love this or like my work as a designer or a product designer, great. But I've been fortunate to be successful at it by the sheer fact of just doing the work. Another question that's always asked to me is, how did you get to be where you are? And I go, well, I've done it for 40 years, first of all. And I just work and I just put my blinders on. It's really easy to look what's going on out there and get confused by, I call it the noise of everybody else, that it distracts you from your focus. Just do it, design it, put it out there. If it doesn't work, go on. We all have failures that we learn from that help us move our careers forward. I've been fortunate with my clients that I've had for many years that are repeat clients. So I think that, how do you bring the polish back? How do you how do you convince people? I think it's a hard question, because how do you convince people that to be an artist or designer, it takes a lot of work? It's not just, I'm a hairdresser today, tomorrow I'm a designer because it seems really fun. And they do it for a year, and then all of a sudden they just, where's so-and-so? Well, they're back to doing hair. Well, you got to have the tenacity and just stick with stuff. You can't just do it because it seems fun for a while. Because it is fun, but it's work. Everything that all of us do, there's a work aspect to it. Like I say, I feel really fortunate because I get to do it and I have a team of people to work with that makes my life easier to really do aspects that I love to do. So, but you have to create that team. You have to find the right people. It takes time, and people are very impatient. I think part of what has to happen is be patient, work really hard, just roll up your sleeves, and do the work, and do good work, and your rewards will come. It's like people that want to be published all the time. I don't even submit work. I just like, I'm fortunate because I think part of what the success now is, if you're around long enough, people think, wow, he must be good, you know, which is kind of funny to me. But I guess it's true. I've made a career of it for 40 years, so I guess I'm doing something right. Or there's, you know, we're in a subjective world too, so there's enough people that like what I'm doing, so it works. I think people are afraid though. I think they're afraid of either their own talent. They don't have the right personality. I mean, you gotta be pretty thick-skinned out there. It's tough. And I don't think they realize that. So when people get over that, I think we'll start to see a resurgence of designers doing the work for just the work, not for the accolades of, I'm really famous, I just did a collection of furniture for so-and-so. Just do the work for the sake of the enjoyment of the work and the enjoyment of your clients and their praises. I think we're so the big picture. I want to have 5 million hits on my Instagram account. Well, that's not paying your bills. That's not making you famous. You know, it's not the way you do it. But I think if you kind of, like I say, go back to the basics, because there's no secret formula to become famous. I don't think. Because part of it is, for me, like you said, part of the conversation is about, I don't follow the rules. I don't care if I'm famous. If you know me, I'm flattered. But my objective is not to be like, oh, I hope everywhere I go, people recognize me. It's not my objective. I want to make stuff. I want to curate stuff here. I want to find cool vintage stuff. I want to design furniture. I want to do interiors. And if I do the work, then that's why I say I like to live in my bubble.
You know, speaking of the bubble, I think it's really cool. And that's why one of the things that I think is very cool is the fact that you are a showroom owner and that you do curate your own showroom. I've had a similar conversation with Patrick Dragonet. Uh-huh. And it really is, there's a different spin when you have your own room. When you have your own showroom and this is your space. You're not designing it for someone else. You're not even designing it. You're curating it. You're filling it in a place. You wouldn't live this way. You're filling it with things that make you happy in some way, shape, or form. What's your strategy? Does the strategy change? How do you fill a room with things that you like? And are you doing it because it's what you're crushing on right now? Is it because it's what you think is going to be on the popularity spectrum in 6-8 months from now? Are these just things that make you happy? And if people buy them, that's great. And if they don't, you've still got your design business. You're still an artist. You've still got the showroom. What's your approach?
The space, the Gibson space, is totally selfish and for me. Everything in here I've picked, everything I've curated. But it's an extension of our office. It's like the European atelier where, you know, you had a shop below and you lived upstairs, and it's, I don't live upstairs, but I'm just saying is that's the sensibility. My desk is in the heart of it. I sit in amongst this, and I want things that I enjoy around me and inspire me. And I look around, and I'll work, I'll take a break, and I'll fuss with things and move them around. But the key is it's all my choice. Like you say, I don't have a client to say, no, I don't like it, or a customer saying I don't like it, or whatever. If you don't like it, you can just turn around and leave. And so for me, it's almost selfish because I created it as my studio. That's, I say we're a designer with a store. And so over the years, we've had the success of enough design. I mean, every great designer that I greatly respect from all over the country and the world actually have been in. And so I'm really flattered when they like it and purchase stuff, because it's like minds get it. And we get a lot of people from the East Coast or even Europe, and they go, God, there's nothing like this. And that feeds the ego for me, because when people understand objects of different sorts and provenances and periods, because it's just stuff, but stuff placed in the right way makes a difference. And like you say, I wouldn't live with all this stuff, but I could pick five great things for any home and put them in their homes, and people go, oh my God, that's such a cool thing. And it enhances, it's another layer to what they already have. And people will come back and say, oh my God, I just did like this little homage to Gibson. I did my coffee table like yours. And I go, oh, that's cool. And because you want to educate people that the placement of things aren't just thrown on a table. There's a placement, there's a strategy to it, there's a rational way of doing it. It's like the salon style of hanging art. It's not just thrown up there. There's a method to this madness. And I also call my desk like organized chaos, because it's full of stuff, but it's all like laid out in a certain way. And when you do that, I always use the analogy, I'm not a hoarder. It's just, I like a lot of stuff, but if you present it in a way that I don't have a warehouse full of stuff, I don't have a garage full of stuff, it's like what I own is out here for everyone to see. So if you like it, then I've been successful. And so that's how I treat this stuff, is just, here's my studio, you're welcome. I like the music, I like the people, I like the camaraderie, I like the relationships you develop with people that come in. I love the repeat clients, the designers that come in, and they're looking for specific things. And they go, Gary, I know you're going to have this, I need this, this, and this. And then they take stuff for their projects. And I mean, that's really rewarding to me. It's like if I did a painting and people go, oh my God, I have to have this. It's the same thing with these objects that I found and curated and put in here. I got to have that.
So if you could pinpoint things, let me back up a second. To you, what is the difference between a trend and a fad?
They seem the same to me.
Do they?
Well, a fad is probably a broader... I think they're all temporary, but they're all, a fad is like, I guess, a phase in someone's life of, on a broader scale to me. I mean, to me, trend and fad is kind of synonymous. I don't.
Okay. I think some could view it as a fad being something that is truly temporary. It comes and then it goes. A trend could be temporary, but doesn't necessarily have to be temporary. So a trend could turn into something that does have legs. And I think that sometimes...
Well, I think mid-century is a classic example of a trend that I thought would be done 10 years ago. I'm old enough that I grew up with mid-century furniture. So I've never been like, oh my God, I got to have that. Because I grew up with it. And I think it's kind of a rebellion against like what I grew up with. But I still like key pieces from that period. But I think that's a great example of a trend that did have legs. And it still does. And I'm kind of wondering, I don't think no one's been brave enough, maybe. What's the next trend in furniture? And I think it's actually going to go back to more classic antiques. Like I told you, I was talking at West Week about antiques back into the environments of interiors. And I said, I don't think they ever left. I tend to use one or two antiques in all our projects. Our projects tend to be eclectic and livable, and there's an elegance to them, but they're casual and livable for the most part. So I go, there's always some antique, be it a lamp, be it a table, whatever. And that was based on a trend. That was the question. And I don't think for a lot of designers, that's a trend. It's part of the lexicon of what we use all the time. I think the fad thing is, and I know they use trends as like colors, and I go, you know, like apricot and chocolate brown's the new hot trend. It drives me nuts because, first of all, who likes that combination? And I know people do. I do like chocolate brown. But because I like saturated color, but I don't base it on, I got to use it because it's the latest trend. I use it because I think the light in this house should have a really saturated color on these walls, because the sunlight, you know, there's a theory and a basis of how I'm coming up with the color I'm using. It wasn't because a magazine said navy blue is hot this summer. You know, and I've never followed that, and I've always over the years been asked by magazines, what's the latest trend? And I go, I don't have a quote for you, because I don't believe in that, because I think for the most part people don't really live like that, at least my clients, and that goes back to my bubble. And I know that it exists because there's many businesses and magazines, and it's a huge shelter community of based on trends, colors, seashells are in, you know, like, I don't know, whatever is the hottest thing. So and there's a big business to that.
So that being said, and it's, I appreciate it. You, I didn't even have to ask the question because you took me exactly where I wanted to go. Thank you. That being said, you as an individual can rediscover things, and they can be a trend to you, or it can be something that excites you. What are you excited about right now? Are there any things that you've rediscovered recently? Anything new that you found that you just really like using? Knowing that every job is different and everything is unique, but are there any things that you've rediscovered that you're excited about?
You know, I love stuff that is. I love wood. So anything integrated with wood, I'm like excited about. But on a vintage level, I tend to like really cool pieces, like wood pieces, boxes that have been made over the years based on someone's need, be it like a carpenter. He made a box for all his tools, specific to his tools that he needed. To me, it's about the hunt. On the venture side, so anything unusual that's out of the ordinary with a narrative that's like, God, this box is 80 years old that this guy carried, and the patina of something is what's so beautiful against the beautifully bronze modern coffee table or something. So that whole juxtaposition of materials really excites me, and I think that stone mixed with polished stainless steel, because our furniture is stainless steel, bronze, and hardwoods. So I love that juxtaposition of materials. When I find a new wood that I haven't used before, and the use of a bronze, light or dark. Like we've recently done, I got excited about doing these bronze castings with white bronze. And it looks like stainless steel and it tarnishes like sterling. So we've done a series of botanical things. And so as they tarnish, like we did a walnut, we've done tree branches and pods and stuff like that. When they tarnish, you get that great texture of the surface. I think surface textures excite me. So when I say all this, this is where more I feel more like an artist. And this is where I feel, going back to your beginning of how I have not approached any of this the normal way, because I don't think my, when I say like, I don't like trends, I don't like this, I don't like that, like what do I like, you know? And I think it's interesting because we deal with a lot of pickers and they'll go, well, what are you looking for? I said, I'm looking for cool stuff. So when someone says that to me, I can't say I'm looking for a lamp that has leaves on it that are gold. Just bring me all the cool lamps you think are cool, and then I will cherry pick from there. And that's how the store comes about. Of course, I go out when I travel to different parts of the country or wherever I'm doing a project and I shop. But it's the uniqueness of the product for the content of this space. But as far as a specific thing that excites me, it's the next cool thing I find.
And I love that. And that's probably the best place to leave it. And that's why listeners of Convo by Design and viewers, if you check us out on the YouTube channel, where you'll see Gary, that's why I enjoy talking to Gary Gibson so much. So, Gary, thanks for the time.
Thanks, Josh.
Convo by Design is proud to be working with Von Dom Furniture. The design culture is key to their success. It's what pushes them to constantly create new collections that give spaces a new dimension. They create dialogue between environment and form. Von Dom pieces can transform the simplest space into one filled with glamour that's both unique and extraordinary. And isn't that what design is all about? Creating atmospheres where you can take hold of life and enjoy it to the fullest. Von Dom products are simply amazing. Their crafted modern, durable, molded resin, glass, and metal designs are unique. They beg to be enjoyed, and very soon you'll be seeing them featured in Convo by Design videos, as well as the set design at some amazing design-focused events. Don't want to wait? I wouldn't either. You can find them in their showrooms at the D&D Building in New York, Wynwood in Miami, and their newest showroom at the Pacific Design Center in Los Angeles, or online at vondom.com.